Pacifica. This is Democracy Now!
Same old, has not been working for us. We need only look around us and see this. It's time for a better way. Do you wait or do you act? From Message to the Movement, this is Mumia Abu-Jamal.
Former death row prisoner Mumia Abu-Jamal. His supporters marked his 58th birthday yesterday outside the Justice Department, calling on the Attorney General to open a federal probe into his case. We'll speak with actor Danny Glover, longtime supporter who's now playing Supreme Court Justice Thurgood Marshall for HBO. Then, today is 1T Day, the day U.S. student debt reaches $1 trillion.
Check this out, all right? I'm the President of the United States. We only finished paying off our student loans about 8 years ago.
We'll look at the Occupy student debt campaign with organizer Pamela Brown and discuss the Occupy movement with social theorist David Harvey.
It's a desperate moment in the sense that if we're going to come out of this crisis in any different kind of way, it's going to be because of the formation of very strong social movements that say enough is enough.
David Harvey is author of Rebel Cities, From the Right to the City to the Urban Revolution. All that and more coming up. Welcome to Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, The War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman. Mitt Romney has all but wrapped up the Republican nomination following victories in all five of Tuesday's Northeastern primaries. Romney added to his delegate lead with victories in New York, Pennsylvania, Connecticut, Rhode Island and Delaware. His main rival, Rick Santorum, bowed out of the race earlier this month, and the third-place challenger, Newt Gingrich, is expected to follow suit. Speaking in New Hampshire, Romney said the Republican primary contest has come to an end.
After 43 primaries and caucuses, many long days, and more than a few long nights, I can say with confidence and gratitude that you have given me a great honor and solemn responsibility. And together, we are going to win on November 6th.
Attorneys for the alleged Army whistleblower Bradley Manning have issued a new request for the military to dismiss all charges in the case. On Tuesday, Manning attorney David Combs said military prosecutors had committed widespread discovery violations that should allow Manning to walk free without prejudice. A judge is expected to rule on the defense's request today. Manning faces up to life imprisonment for allegedly leaking classified documents that ended up on the whistleblowing website WikiLeaks. Syrian forces are apparently continuing attacks on anti-government protesters following the departure of UN monitors from key areas. The Douma suburb of Damascus was reportedly shelled this morning, just 2 days after anti-government protesters staged a rally during a monitoring team visit. More than 30 people were reportedly killed Monday in the central city of Hama, when troops fired automatic weapons. A spokesperson for the special envoy, Kofi Annan, said there are credible reports that security forces are targeting people who approach observers. The UN plans to send dozens more monitors to Syria, but Secretary of State Hillary Clinton said the U.S. is preparing additional steps in case the peace plan fails. In a briefing to the Security Council, Special Envoy Kofi Annan said the attacks, if confirmed, would be, quote, totally unacceptable and reprehensible. The U.S. Ambassador to the United Nations, Susan Rice, also criticized the Syrian government.
Our patience is exhausted. The fact that the violence continues despite, you know, the so-called ceasefire of April 12th is, in our view, not only unacceptable, but reprehensible. And we've been very clear in supporting the dispatch of the balance of the monitoring mission that the onus remains on the Syrian government to halt the violence, and then subsequently on both sides to maintain a cessation of violence and allow the observers to move freely and do their work without any obstruction.
Pakistan is claiming to have successfully tested an intermediate-range ballistic missile capable of carrying both nuclear and conventional warheads. The move comes less than 1 week after India carried out a similar test. Both countries have conducted missile tests since revealing their nuclear capabilities 14 years ago. Israel's retroactively legalized three Jewish-only settlement outposts in the occupied West Bank while delaying the scheduled evacuation of a fourth. The move could mark a further extremist shift for the Israeli government, which has long insisted on its right to expand settlements considered illegal under international law, but vowed to crack down on settlement outposts that haven't received government authorization. Sharif Yassin, a Palestinian resident in the West Bank whose land was seized to build the Beit El settlement, said Israel's attempting to legalize theft.
We own this land. Netanyahu will not give it to us for free. After being at the Israeli courts and getting verdicts that it is ours and it belonged to our fathers and grandfathers, we used to plant in it before they kicked us out. I used to plant in this land myself.
In Washington, State Department spokesperson Victoria Nuland offered mild criticism of the new Israeli settlement grab, saying, quote, "We don't think this is helpful to the process, and we don't accept the legitimacy of continued settlement activity." Two Israeli lawmakers, meanwhile, are drawing controversy for a photograph showing them posing on the sofa of a recently evicted Palestinian family in East Jerusalem. The Nacha family was forced out of their home last week to make way for Jewish settlers after an 8-year effort by the Israeli government to evict them. The land had been in their family since the 1930s. A photograph posted on Facebook shows Israeli Knesset members Michael Ben-Ari and Aryeh Eldad boastfully lounging on the Nacha family's sofa on the property's front lawn. New research shows that for the first time since the Great Depression, more Mexican immigrants may be leaving the United States than entering. The study from the Pew Hispanic Center found the U.S. job market, increased border enforcement, a rise in deportations, and other factors had slowed the net rate of migration from Mexico to zero or even less. The news comes as states like Alabama and Arizona have implemented controversial laws to target undocumented people living in the United States. The dangers associated with illegal border crossing were cited as one specific reason for the decline. You can go to our website at democracynow.org to hear the story of a Mexican father who died after being tased and beaten by U.S. border agents in California while trying to enter the United States. The Supreme Court will hear arguments today in a case challenging Arizona's notorious anti-immigrant law 2 years after its passage. The Obama administration's challenged four provisions of the law known as SB 1070 for interfering with federal immigration enforcement. Immigrant rights groups have organized a number of protests and vigils nationwide to coincide with today's hearing. Ben Winograd of the American Immigration Council said the Supreme Court ruling will have major implications nationwide as a number of states seek to pass copycat measures.
Allowing states to be the primary enforcers of federal immigration law would, from a civil rights perspective, have huge ramifications. All of a sudden, every traffic stop that is conducted by a local officer and involves someone who arguably looks or sounds like an immigrant could result in an extended detention and even possibly incarceration.
A former drilling engineer for oil giant BP has been arrested and charged with intentionally destroying evidence sought by authorities after the Deepwater Horizon rig explosion and oil spill 2 years ago. Kurt Mix is the first person to face criminal charges for the disaster, which killed 11 workers and sent nearly 5 million barrels of oil into the Gulf of Mexico. Mix is accused of destroying text messages between himself and a BP supervisor, even though he was told to preserve all information. The messages appear to show Mix was aware that BP's attempt to plug the gushing wellhead with mud, an effort known as Topkill, was failing. They indicate Mix knew oil was flowing at a rate of more than 15,000 barrels a day at a time when the public was being told the rate was 5,000 barrels per day. Mix is being charged with two counts of obstruction of justice and could face up to 20 years in prison and fines of $250,000 for each count. Federal officials say they've discovered the first new case of mad cow disease since 2006. An infection was found in a dairy cow in California. But the Agriculture Department says it's been contained and poses no threat to the nation's food supply. John Clifford, the department's chief veterinary officer, made the announcement.
First off, this particular animal did not enter the food supply at any time, so there is no concern about that. In addition, the safety of our food is addressed through our interlocking safeguards and through the removal of any type of material that could taint the BSE agent in the United States. Therefore, we continually protect public health through the removal of these materials.
Hundreds of Occupy protesters from across the country gathered in San Francisco Tuesday for a massive demonstration at the banking giant Wells Fargo's annual shareholders meeting. Several dozen activists had purchased company stock and were allowed inside. Police said two dozen people were arrested, including 15 who disrupted the meeting. Protesters inside shouted for Wells Fargo to pay a fair share of corporate taxes. They also condemned the company's investment in private prisons and called for an end to foreclosures. Meanwhile, protesters outside the city's Merchants Exchange building blocked the street, chanting, "We are the 99%. Anti-war demonstrators in Chicago are alleging censorship after being told they'll be kept away from next month's NATO summit. On Tuesday, the Secret Service said protesters will be barred from coming within at least two blocks of the site where leaders from NATO countries will meet. The umbrella protest group, the Coalition Against NATO G8 War and Poverty Agenda, says the restriction will violate their right to be within sight and sound of summit attendees. Organizers say they're expecting thousands of demonstrators for the opening rally on May 20th, the NATO summit's first day. The State Department has dropped its effort to stop a Pakistani lawyer who represents victims of CIA drone strikes from entering the United States. Shahzad Akbar is scheduled to speak later this month at an international drone summit in Washington, D.C. His trip had remained in limbo after the U.S. government failed to grant him a visa. While he's traveled to the United States in the past, he had not been granted permission to return since becoming an outspoken critic of the drone strikes and filing the first case in Pakistan on behalf of families of civilian victims. But on Tuesday, after months of public protests, the State Department backed down and granted Akbar a travel visa. In a statement, Akbar said, "I will be speaking to American people about the loss of so many innocent Pakistani lives in their name. I believe the American people are good people and will want to do something to stop this unjust, counterproductive war," he said. And the Justice Department is refusing to reopen an investigation into the Kent State shootings just weeks ahead of its 42nd anniversary. On May 4, 1970, National Guardsmen opened fire on hundreds of unarmed students at an anti-war rally at Ohio's Kent State University. Four students were killed, nine others wounded. Survivors of the massacre had called for a new federal probe 2 years ago following the discovery of an audio tape from the day of the shootings. The survivors say a National Guard officer can be heard issuing a command to fire, followed by gunshots. But on Tuesday, the Justice Department rejected the request, saying the new audio tape was inconclusive. A group of Kent State survivors say they plan to respond by bringing the case to an international court. And those are some of the headlines. This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, The War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman.
And I'm Nermeen Sheikh. Welcome to our listeners and viewers around the country and around the world. Hundreds of supporters of former death row prisoner Mumia Abu-Jamal marked his 58th birthday yesterday by protesting outside the Justice Department in Washington, D.C. Mumia Abu-Jamal is a former Black Panther and journalist who was sentenced to death in 1982 for the killing of Philadelphia police officer Daniel Faulkner. For decades, he has argued racism by the trial judge and prosecutors led to his conviction. In January this year, Abu-Jamal was transferred from solitary confinement to the general prison population. Last year, the Third U.S. Circuit Court of Appeals agreed with a lower judge who set aside Abu-Jamal's death sentence after finding jurors were given confusing instructions that encouraged them to choose death rather than a life sentence. Yesterday, Abu-Jamal's supporters called on Attorney General Eric Holder and the White House to open a federal probe into his case that could lead to his release.
I'm here to ask President Barack Obama to let Mumia go. He never committed a crime.
The Occupy the Justice Department protest also focused on the inequalities of the U.S. justice system and the privatization of the prison industry. Speaking to prison radio shortly before the April 24th action, Mumia Abu-Jamal addressed his supporters and the wider Occupy movement.
The real deal is Occupy everything. Where the people are, there should you be. Where power and wealth are hurting the people, there you should be organizing, resisting, fighting back, winning a better world. You will succeed if you fight hard enough, for despite what the corporate media echoes, the majority of the people are on your side. You're voicing their concerns, their fears, and their sense of mass betrayal. In fact, it has largely been the corporate Dow Jones reporting media that has betrayed their readers, listeners, and viewers, not only by selling the wars, but by selling their corporate visions to the world, in effect, by being their mouthpieces. That's where the big bucks are. So to defend their masters, the lords of high finance, they will try to savage you. Note that this is but a signal of your success and a reflection of their bosses' fears. Keep on rolling. Keep on moving. And while you do it, treat each other as brothers and sisters, compañeros y compañeras. Care for each other. For that in itself will distinguish your movement from the market-driven carelessness and selfishness that characterizes the age of globalized capital. Same old has not been working for us. We need only look around us and see this. It's time for a better way. Do you wait or do you act? From message to the movement, this is Mumia Abu-Jamal.
That message of Mumia Abu-Jamal was played for the 824 Occupy the DOJ protest yesterday. Over the years, Mumia Abu-Jamal has become one of the world's most high-profile prisoners. In a forthcoming film called Long Distance Revolutionary, A Journey with Mumia Abu-Jamal, some of his supporters explained why his case continues to matter. These are some of the voices of his supporters, from Professor Cornel West to writer Tariq Ali, Mike Africa, publisher Jeg Ruggiero, and journalist Lynn Washington. It begins with the former prisoner Reuben Hurricane Carter.
Mumia Abu-Jamal is one of the lost souls of the revolution.
Mumia, how are you dealing with all of this darkness and despair and despondency and so forth? He said, let me write about it. I'll tell the truth about it. It's a living hell. It's a nightmare.
They have moved heaven and earth to stop his voice being heard in the United States.
Anybody who has the ability to draw a crowd with their voice and then speak truth? Oh, my God.
Mumia Abu-Jamal is a revolutionary person. So he's like a guerrilla in the jungle, in a tent in the rain, writing to the community with next to nothing.
So here we have somebody who defiantly says, yes, I'm not only a journalist, but I'm a revolutionary journalist. And no, I don't agree with anything that you're doing. And yes, I have an international platform. Interestingly enough, a platform that I never used to talk about my own case. They want him ground up.
An excerpt from the forthcoming documentary, Long Distance Revolutionary, A Journey with Mumia Abu-Jamal, directed by Steve Vittoria. Well, for more, we're going to Philadelphia, Pennsylvania, to attorney Judith Ritter. She's represented a Mumia Abu-Jamal since 2002. She's the director of the Criminal Defense Clinic at Widener Law School. We welcome you to Democracy Now! First of all, I think there are a lot of people who do not even realize, Judith Ritter, that Mumia Abu-Jamal is a former death row prisoner, that he has been moved off of death row. Can you explain where he is and how this happened?
Yes, it's true, but it's only since January of this year that he has been in the general population. You know, what people may have heard is that the death penalty was set aside in his case, but that was originally in 2001 by a federal district court judge here in Philadelphia. and yet he was only removed from death row in December of 2011. Now, the reason for that is because the prosecuting attorney appealed our victory in the federal court, and there's been appeals that we've been arguing over all of these years. The case, the DA asked the Supreme Court to take the case. The Supreme Court sent it back to the Third Circuit. We had a second argument in the Third Circuit, went back to the Supreme Court, where they refused to review the setting aside of his death penalty. But all of that took many years, and the policy of the Department of Corrections here in Pennsylvania is, as long as these appeals are pending, they won't take an inmate off of death row. So despite the fact that his sentence was set aside in 2001, he was on death row until December of this year. He was in a high maximum security facility in western Pennsylvania when the district attorney in Philadelphia announced that they would not seek a new penalty phase. I mean, when we had the ruling from the Supreme Court that they would not review the case, the district attorney here in Philly did have the option of seeking a new death sentence. They announced in December last year that they would not. He was then moved off of death row. He's now in a medium security facility, a lot closer to Philadelphia, which is good for his lawyers and for his family and close friends, in order to see him a lot more often. And he was just moved to general population in January. And the reason that he's not on death row, as you said at the beginning of this segment, is that the death penalty was set aside because the jury instructions were found by not just, you know, one judge, but at some point about four federal judges as being unconstitutionally misleading. So that the jury who voted for him to have the death sentence, the courts have determined, were given instructions that were incorrect on the law, and incorrect in a way that would make it more likely that they would vote for death, and that's what happened. So the death sentence is now off the horizon here, which is obviously a very, very wonderful thing. Mumia is in general population. But, you know, as you all, I think, know, he's certainly not free, and he will be shortly resentenced to life without possibility of parole.
So, Judy Ritter, just to clarify, even though he's been removed from death row, his first-degree murder conviction still stands. Is that correct?
That's correct. And the only alternative sentence—the only alternative sentence for that is life without parole.
And is that the best that we can hope for now?
Well, you know, his supporters, his lawyers are, you know, continuing to work on his behalf. What's, you know, important for people to know, and probably most people don't know, is that the laws in the past, 10 years, the laws have changed so that it makes it very, very difficult for a state prisoner to get into federal court and convince the court there to overturn their conviction. The federal courts are required by law. This was a law signed in to law by Bill Clinton in 1996. It made federal habeas corpus relief very, very difficult to achieve. It gives deference to the state court's rulings so that the federal court, even if they disagree with something the state court decided, they still have to give deference and can only do anything if they find it unreasonable. To go back into court with a habeas petition after one has been done is also extremely difficult to do. So there's room for litigation, and we're working on his behalf, and we'll continue to do so.
And so what is it that you're planning now in terms of subsequent action?
I don't think it's appropriate for me to comment on legal strategies, you know, at this point, and I'd prefer not to do that. But as I said, there are things about this case that have yet to be investigated, believe it or not, after all these years. And, you know, we've got a team of lawyers and very, very hardworking, dedicated activists who are working very, very hard. And that's not just activists in Philly and not just activists in the United States, but all over the world. Mm-hmm.
Judith Ritter, I want to go to the district attorney, to Seth Williams. Back in January, he said he'll appeal the federal court's decision to grant a new sentencing hearing for Abu Jamal. Can you respond to this?
What happened was they did appeal, and they appealed for many, many years, when the U.S. Supreme Court said that they would, in October of 2011, so this past October, said, we will not review the case. That was the end of the line for any appeals by the district attorney's office. The only thing they could have done at that point was to convene a new jury, try to convince a new jury now to issue a death sentence. And they announced in early December at a press conference in Philadelphia that they would not seek that, that they would not try to have a new sentence of death imposed, which leaves the sentence that hasn't been officially imposed yet, but will be, as life without parole.
This is Seth Williams. This is what he had to say, the Philadelphia district attorney.
What I'm going to do is I'm going to review fully the opinion of the Court of Appeals. But it is my belief at this point that I will ask the Supreme Court to clarify and to make a decision on what we should do at this point.
That was Philadelphia District Attorney Seth Williams. Judith Ritter.
He did ask the Supreme Court. His office did ask the Supreme Court to review it, and the Supreme Court declined to review the case.
Judith Ritter, what do you say to Daniel Faulkner's family, who says his supporters will just never accept that Mumia Abu-Jamal was convicted of murdering her husband?
Well, there are good reasons that the conviction is not acceptable to many, many all over the world, and that is because there were many, many unfairnesses in this trial. There was a federal habeas corpus petition that was filed in late 90s, had 32 counts alleging improprieties in the trial, not just in the penalty phase, but in the trial. There's evidence that witnesses were intimidated in order to get them to testify. There was very strong proof that the district attorney who handled the trial discriminated in jury selection in order to remove African Americans from the jury. And that was a strong claim. The federal courts rejected it. In fact, when they rejected that claim, it was because at that point they adopted a new standard for hearing those jury discrimination claims that they had never used before. But in Mumia's case, they did adopt it in the Third Circuit. You know, there were, I don't know that anyone, you know, should be comfortable with a conviction, with even a life sentence that is based upon a trial that had lots of racial issues infused in it by the prosecutor's office, and where the jury was unfairly chosen, and, you know, on and on. There were lots of issues, you know. Forensic evidence was questionable, and the testimony associated with forensic evidence was questionable. And years later, we've been able to show that. But unfortunately, as I said, the law makes it very difficult to succeed on post-conviction attacks on state court convictions.
We're talking to Judith Ritter, who has represented Mumia Abu-Jamal since 2002. What about his access now? Explain the prison where he is, the circumstances right now of where he is incarcerated.
Yeah. Well, it's a vast improvement over death row. You know, not just that he doesn't have a death sentence hanging over his head, but that he is no longer in a cell 23 out of 24 hours a day. He used to be able to get about an hour of being outdoors when he was on death row for all those many years. But there was never any sunlight in the small area that he was allowed to walk in. Now he can, you know, enjoy sunlight, go outdoors, have contact visits with his family, with, you know, anyone who visits him. He is a lot more, you know, able to do the kinds of things that keep him going, you know. You all just heard that, you know, I think it's great that you played his message that he delivered to the protest yesterday. You know, he's remarkably so, you know, mentally and physically healthy still after such, you know, difficult circumstances for so many years. But he keeps his, you know, he writes, as you all know. He delivers radio addresses regularly. He reads more than anyone I know. He keeps up with current events. In a way that's amazing to me. And he, you know, he plays music. He's now, for the first time, being able to have a musical instrument, which he wasn't allowed on death row. So he's in a better place. But, you know, he's hasn't been free for 30 years. But he's in a new place now, and it's better, no question about it. And through it all, he's you know, has, keeps up, you know, his spirits, and he's funny, and he's, and as I think someone said in the thing you played earlier, you You know, he doesn't talk about himself. You have to really get him to try to talk about his case. He's interested in what's going on in the world and the suffering of really, you know, everybody but himself.
Judith Ritter, I want to thank you very much for being with us as Representative Mumia Abu-Jamal since 2002, professor of law and director of the Criminal Defense Clinic at Widener Law School, speaking to us from Philadelphia. This is Democracy Now! We'll be back in a minute. Guns are drawn by the roots. This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, The War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman with Nermeen Sheikh.
Today marks what activists are calling 1T Day, the day U.S. student debt reaches $1 trillion. A coalition of groups from Occupy Wall Street plan to gather on college campuses and communities around the country to protest record-high college costs and call for an extension of low-interest rates on federally subsidized Stafford loans. The rates were reduced to 3.4% in 2007, but will double on July 1st for new loans unless Congress intervenes. According to the coalition, 2010 graduates had, on average, over $25,000 in student debts. As Republican presidential hopeful Mitt Romney moves closer to becoming the official Republican nominee who will challenge Democratic President Barack Obama in November's general election, both candidates are concentrating on wooing the youth vote, pointing especially to the issue of student debt. Speaking to students at the University of North Carolina in Chapel Hill, Obama said every American family should be able to afford higher education.
We can't price the middle class out of a college education. Not at a time when most new jobs in America will require more than a high school diploma. Whether it's at a four-year college or a two-year program, we can't make higher education a luxury. It's an economic imperative. Every American family should be able to afford it.
President Obama will also speak at the University of Colorado in Boulder and the University of Iowa in Iowa City. Romney's victories in five primary states Tuesday earned him numerous delegates and allows him to focus on the general election campaign against Obama. He's backed Obama's proposal to extend low rates on government-subsidized student loans through next year. To talk more about the issue of student debt, we're joined by Pamela Brown. She's a sociology PhD student at the New School who helped launch the Occupy Student Debt campaign, Pledge of Refusal. Pam, welcome to Democracy Now! What's the Pledge of Refusal?
Hi. Thanks for having me, Amy. Thank you. The Pledge of Refusal asks that a million people come together to unite and refuse student debt. And the reason that we need to do that is we need to end our complicity with Wall Street at this point in terms of the $1 trillion crisis that we're dealing with. It's really just become an issue that we need to take action on, take direct action. And this is a nonviolent, direct action form of civil disobedience. It's a form of non-cooperation with Wall Street.
Can you explain that, though, Pamela Brown? Because I think most people are under the impression that these loans are with the government, the debts are with the government, but you say Wall Street is involved.
That's absolutely correct. And that's a big problem that we have in terms of having people understand the true situation. The government only recently began to take on the majority of direct lending. So that's only in recent years. The vast majority of the $1 trillion worth of student debt is actually held by Wall Street banks. And those banks actually securitize these loans, and they sell them off, and they make enormous profits from them. Furthermore, even the loans that are held by the government are ultimately securitized. Companies are paid, they're compensated for servicing these loans. Because so many people are actually unable to pay them, we have a crisis where we have about 5 million people who are actually in default, and then there are companies that make enormous profits off of collecting on these loans, and these are Wall Street companies.
Can you say a little about the action that's planned today? What exactly are you planning to
do? Today is a National Day of Action, and we're commemorating this horrible milestone, which is $1 trillion of student debt. There are actions planned throughout the country. Here in New York, we're going to meet in Union Square at 4 p.m. We're going to have Reverend Billy, who's going to give us a debt jubilee, where we are going to free ourselves of this enormous burden. Nationally, there are actions planned throughout the United States at various colleges, as well as at all of the Sallie Mae regional offices, as well as the D.C. Headquarters.
At the same address in North Carolina, President Obama explained the implications of doubling interest rates on student debt.
5 years ago, Congress cut the rate on federal student loans in half. That was a good thing to do. But on July 1st, that's a little over 2 months from now, that rate cut expires. And if Congress does nothing, the interest rates on those loans will double overnight. So I'm assuming a lot of people here have federal student loans. The interest rates will double unless Congress acts by July 1st. And just to give you some sense of perspective, for each year that Congress doesn't act, the average student with these loans will rack up an additional $1,000 in debt, an extra $1,000. That's basically a tax hike for more than 7 million students across America, more than 160,000 students here in North Carolina alone.
President Obama speaking at North Carolina yesterday, Pam Brown. Position of the Republicans and the Democrats.
Well, it's good to know that they are at this point that both Mitt Romney and President Obama are in favor of keeping this reduction of the interest rate. But we have to also understand that this particular rate that we're talking about only applies to newly originated federal loans that are taken out recently. It does nothing to solve the massive $1 trillion problem whatsoever.
And what about the various reform proposals that Congress is looking at now, from bankruptcy to debt forgiveness? Can you talk about those?
Sure. Well, to start with the bankruptcy proposal, I mean, these proposals have been over many years, there have been many different proposals. I think there's been at least 4 different bills in Congress just trying to restore bankruptcy protection, even in some cases just in the case of being in a horrible accident where you're no longer able to work. These are very small requests, and none of them have ever passed. So that's problematic. In terms of the forgiveness bill, it could be a great measure. Of course, anything that can alleviate the suffering of recent generations who really find this debt unpayable could be useful, but it's very unlikely that it's actually going to pass. And once again, it only deals with a small amount of the problem.
Let's bring in David Harvey, Distinguished Professor of Anthropology at the Graduate Center of City University of New York. You have a new book called Rebel Cities, From the Right to the City to the Urban Revolution. Your comment on this day, what is being called 1T Day, the day student debt has reached $1 trillion in the United States.
One thing, there's an immense contradiction. On the one hand, we're being told we should accept a great deal of austerity because we don't want to saddle future generations with this enormous federal debt. At the same time, as we're actually saddling a whole generation of students with immense personal debt. So go figure. I mean, it doesn't make any sense. The other thing I would say is I went through a tuition-free system. I was educated with no tuition. And my own university, CUNY, was tuition-free up until the 1970s, and then a huge campaign was waged by the Business Roundtable the Rockefeller brothers and everything else to impose tuition on CUNY. And ever since then, there's been this immense attempt by corporations and the wealthy and so on to pass the costs of education onto the people who are being educated. Now, this is what something that the economists call externalities. That is, they don't want to pay for training their own labor force. They want the labor force to train itself, and then they'll use it. But the result of that is we have this enormous defect in American higher education. I mean, this is one of the least educated countries now out of all of the OECD countries. The achievement in math and science are way, way down compared to everywhere else. And, you know, this is a disaster from the standpoint of the national interest.
Let me ask. I was watching some right-wing pundits on television yesterday who were saying, this is interestingly enough, they were saying a bailout of these universities whose costs have gone out of control, that's what the government subsidies are all about. The loans are all about subsidizing these universities. They should just bring down their costs.
Well, it's true in the sense that the costs of higher education have been escalated in this. I mean, they're way, way beyond the rate of inflation. Tuition rates have been going up. But even in a City University of New York, which is we're having to impose higher tuitions because austerity comes from Albany and says we have less money from the state. And so, you know, it's putting the costs of education onto the people who are being educated and their long-term costs, as you mentioned, $1 trillion now. And you kind of go, this is unacceptable. This is debt peonage for a large chunk of the population.
Pamela Brown, can you talk a little bit about how this debt is divided among the student population, the racial dimensions of a debt distribution?
Right. Numbers are somewhat like, I believe it's 1 in 4 Caucasian students have under $13,000 worth of debt, whereas 1 in 3 African American students have over $38,000 worth of student debt. So student debt is really a critical juncture in the production of inequality that we're dealing with in society right now, and it's something that Occupy Wall Street has been raising awareness about.
We're going to interrupt the broadcast because right now we have just gotten a call from Mumia Abu-Jamal from prison in Pennsylvania. Mumia Abu-Jamal is speaking to us for the first time, no longer on death row. Mumia Abu-Jamal, can you tell us where you are? Welcome to Democracy Now.
Good morning, Amy, and good morning to Democracy Now. I am in the open room, the block out area of SCI Mahanoy, a prison in Schuylkill County in northeastern Pennsylvania.
Mumia Abu-Jamal, can you say how the conditions there are different from the prison from which you were moved?
Well, in many ways they're similar, but in only in kind of dimension are they different. That is to say, everything is bigger. For nearly 3 decades, I was in what could be called a dog run or a small dog cage with one other fellow from death row. The difference between that and going to a cage, a yard, that is about a mile wide with about 400 or 500 other men is pretty profound.
Well, can you talk about what your reaction is to be taken off of death row, to no longer have death hanging over you, but to be in jail for a life sentence without parole?
Well, you've kind of answered the question with your question. That is to say,
this call is from the State Correctional Institution at Mahanoy and is subject to monitoring and recording.
You've probably heard me refer to life as slow death row. It sounds a little dramatic, but it is really more truth to it than hyperbole. And that's because, you know, in Pennsylvania, it has the highest population, or one of the highest populations in the state, of lifers. In fact, juveniles with life sentences. And in Pennsylvania, there's no gradation. You know, all lifers are lifers, and that's for their whole life. And I guess in that sense, too, it's bigger. I mean, it's bigger in terms of the time differential, but it's slow death row, to be sure. And when you see, as I've seen, going to chow or going to a meal and seeing what I call the million-man wheelchair march, it makes an impact on you. You know, you look up in the morning and there are 30 or 40 guys going to the handicap line, and they're in wheelchairs. And although some are young, most are quite old. And so, you know, life means life in Pennsylvania.
Mumia Abu-Jamal, there was a protest at the Justice Department yesterday, Occupy the DOJ, A24, for your birthday, April 24th. As people there called for the Department of Justice, the Attorney General, to open a probe into your case, what do you want to happen in your case?
Well, as I said to our people there in Washington the other day, yesterday, frankly, we want freedom. I mean, I was thinking this morning as I was being told that, you know, we could possibly talk to you about a case that's in the federal law books called U.S. v. Brown. The person is perhaps better known as Rap Brown or Gerard Brown. Imam Jamil is his name today. This is an old case, I think from the 70s, perhaps. But in this case, a federal case, the judge referred to Brother Jamil at a golf course with other people around as, I'm going to help get rid of this nigger. Think about that in the context of Judge Albert F. Sabo of the Court of Common Pleas of Philadelphia, not saying it on a golf course among friends, but saying this in his chambers, in the courthouse, during a trial, I'm going to help them fry the nigger. This was heard by a court reporter, a member of the court staff, a court employee, and a person that is perhaps the best listener you could ever have for any conversation, because that's her job. She takes notes during trials for a living. Now, we didn't know about it until years later, but when we put this into our papers, our filings, it has been essentially ignored by every court it's come in front of. How is that possible? And so, I mean, that's certainly one indication, as you can see, one example of an unfair system.
Mumia Abu-Jamal, Danny Glover is here also to talk about your case.
Hello, Mumia.
Yes, Brother Danny. How are you?
How are you doing, brother?
Good. Good to hear your voice.
It's good to hear you, as always. And I certainly would feel a lot better, if you were out of jail, not simply just off a death row.
Me and you both.
And but certainly, I just want to tell you that and I'm really emotional because I didn't expect to hear your voice this morning, right there. We continue to struggle, and we'll continue to struggle to fight for your release. We sent a letter to the Attorney General Holder. That we convene a meeting, the federal government use its own authority to investigate your case, and certainly we people are out here, and we love you, brother.
Thank you so much. I assure you, I did not expect to hear your voice either, and I'm pretty emotional about that. You are a hero. For the acting community and the arts community and the drama community and, of course, the black community and beyond that, the international community, for the work you've done in the arts. And I am as pleased as punch and thrilled to hear you there. Thank you. Thank you very much.
Mumia, I think it's interesting that you were talking to Danny Glover, who is currently playing Thurgood Marshall. That's going to be coming out in a HBO series on Muhammad Ali, the Supreme Court Justice.
I think Thurgood himself real chuckle out of that. That's wonderful.
Good. You know, I'm looking forward to seeing you soon. All right, brother?
We shall make that happen.
We will make that happen. Okay. All right.
Mumia Abu-Jamal, your access outside of death row right now to people, to the media, to the phone, you have had so much trouble reaching out over the years, though you have managed.
Well, if you recall, it's been it's maybe 15 years. I think since I last called your show, I was in conversation with you perhaps 1996 or thereabouts, and the phone went dead. And I looked out of my cell, and I saw a guard come up and literally pull the wire out of the wall that connected the phone. And I remember saying, hello, 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 hello. And it was dead because there was no wire to connect us. So as you can see, the wires are a little tighter now.
Well, you sued the Pennsylvania prison authorities over them pulling out the phone from the wall when we were speaking on Democracy Now.
Indeed, I did. And thanks to the efforts of some really brave and conscientious lawyers and judges, I won at least most of the issues in that suit. Abu-Jamal v. Price, I think, was the name of the case.
This call is from the State Correctional Institution at Mahanoy and is subject to monitoring and recording.
And thanks to that case, I was able to write and continue to, you know, be in contact with our people. I'm really glad he pulled that wire out the wall. That was very helpful.
Danny Glover, what do you think Thurgood Marshall would do in the case of Mumia Abu-Jamal?
Well, surprisingly, no, not surprisingly, I think Thurgood Marshall would have been one of the few justices who would perhaps hear the case, would argue to hear the case. Even though there were moments during the Civil Rights Movement that Thurgood Marshall had even trouble with Martin Luther King and disagreed a great deal, but I feel that he would be one who would want to hear the case. Thurgood Marshall, for nothing else, during those dark years in the 30s and 40s, Thurgood Marshall was there before Brown versus the Board of Education, fighting cases all the time of men on death row who were about to have for murder or for rape all over the South, you know. We often know Thurgood Marshall from his work on Brown versus the Board of Education, but clearly his work around inmates, around prisoners, around those who have been accused falsely and fighting for them was something he did all over the country.
I'm afraid we're going to lose Mumia Abu-Jamal in a moment. Mumia Abu-Jamal, your thoughts on what Danny Glover just said about the Supreme Court Justice Thurgood Marshall, and also if you could comment on the Trayvon Martin case and the Occupy movement.
Well, I would concur largely with, not surprisingly, Danny Glover's remarks, because, you know, from what I've read and what I've heard, Justice Thurgood Marshall was not just a brilliant legal mind, and not just a brilliant judge or jurist. He was an incredible lawyer who fought for people who were poor, who were dispossessed, who were powerless in the apartheid South. And also, because he was a black lawyer, his experiences in the South were such that not only were his clients endangered, but he himself was endangered. And many times he would be told that he had to leave town before nightfall, or he would face death. I mean, this was the American South in the middle 20th century. The good thing about that, if there can be a good thing about such an experience, is that when he came to the Supreme Court, those experiences of being a defense lawyer of the poor and the dispossessed and those facing death, he was able to share with his fellow justices, because these were people largely who, let's say, came from a completely different background. And I don't mean racially. I mean class. And I also mean that many of them, most of them, were not defense lawyers. They were either lower court judges or some were legislators. And, you know, mostly they were prosecutors and so forth. So he was able to expand their perspective of what the law really meant in the real world and through his own life experiences. And I think he had a profound impact, if you really check it, on the former Supreme Court Justice Sandra Day O'Connor. If you look at her early jurisprudence and then look at her later jurisprudence, I think it's a direct effect of the influence of Thurgood Marshall. As for Trayvon, the little boy who could have been the son of the President of the United States, when we look at what happened in that case, and in my real view is that in a matter of weeks or months, we may see an immunity hearing that will wipe out the charges completely. And Mr. Zimmerman will never see the inside of a prison. As for the Occupy movement, I think it's one of the greatest advances in the democracy movement in our modern period. And it's pushed because of the economic crisis.
We have 60 seconds remaining.
It's pushed because of the economic crisis that's facing the United States and especially young people who've come out of college and have no hope for a job, have no hope for a future, have no hope for a life without terrifying, crippling loans over their heads. I think they did something wonderful, but it's a first step. They have something else to do, something more important to do, and that's to connect with other people's movements around the country.
We have 30 seconds remaining.
And build a kind of resistance that can transform this country. I thank you all for these brief moments. I really do.
Mumia Abu-Jamal, happy birthday. Happy 58th birthday.
Thank you. Thank you, Amy.
Happy birthday, Mumia.
Thank you, Danny.
Okay.
All the best.
See you soon.
All right, brother.
Mumia Abu-Jamal speaking to us from SCI Mahanoy, the prison in Pennsylvania, where he is no longer on death row. Are you still there, Mumia? His phone has been cut off at this point. Danny Glover, your thoughts right now as you sit down and hear Mumia Abu-Jamal speaking to you, no longer from death row?
Well, it's a beginning, as he says, as he mentioned in terms of the Occupy movement, it's a beginning. We have to find, by as someone would say, by any means necessary, legally, to free and collectively as a community, not only in this country, around the world, to free and to bring him home.
Danny Glover, your thoughts on Trayvon Martin and Mumia Abu-Jamal we've just spoken to. Is the criminal justice system very different now than it was when Mumia Abu-Jamal was convicted?
Certainly, it's framed now in a different way. It is simply still the place. I know those places, and I visit those places that Romeo talks about, where there's a wheelchair caravan of men who are serving life sentences. You take, for instance, Soledad State Prison in California. 40% of the prisons there on life sentences. And you take Vacaville, two places that I visited last year. Also, 40% of the prisoners are lifers, as they would call them, lifers. So the reality is that has not changed. The course from prisons to from high school to communities to prison is still the same course that has happened. What is essentially, and we must be reminded that at the point that Mumia was charged with this crime, and was certainly there were a number of activities, the COINTEL program and other programs, to incite and not only to dismantle those movements and to dissuade young people from becoming progressive and radicalized in different ways within their communities. So here's a journalist, and that's what Mumia is first.
Seconds.
It's a journalist,
and, then we'll continue
and he's the person who is attacked. A journalist now first. Who's attacked in here because of what he has to say.
Danny Glover, we want to thank you very much for being with us. We're going to continue this conversation and post it online in a web exclusive at democracynow.org. I'm Amy Goodman with Nermeen Sheikh. Thanks so much for joining us. Democracy Now! Is a listener-supported grassroots global news hour. You make it possible when you donate at democracynow.org. Thank you so much.